Greetings, film freaks. We are the Podcorn Kernels. Join us as we discuss the hard and often indigestible truths that are at the center of the fluffy and delicious world of cinema.
What's poppin', people? Welcome to the Podcorn Kernels podcast. My name is Adam, and joining me in your ear holes is Harry. Say hello, Harry.
Head down to Dave's Cheese Shack for his new playground sauce.
On today's episode, we will be talking about Interstellar. This is a 2014 film directed by Christopher Nolan and stars Matthew McConaughey, Anne Hathaway, and Jessica Chastain. IMDb describes the synopsis as follows. A team of explorers travel through a wormhole in space in an attempt to ensure humanity's survival. Here is an original song to support the synopsis.
Yeah, check, 1, 2. Yo, Nolan, why are you messing with my mind? I am struggling to find the meaning. Deep cleaning, I've got a feeling. Am I standing on the floor or am I standing on the ceiling? It's demeaning. My brain can't comprehend what crops that you are seeding. My brain is bleeding, like a boiled kettle, my head is steaming.
Let's start with some facts about the film. Anne Hathaway suffered from hypothermia while filming in Iceland due to the fact that her astronaut suit was open while filming scenes in the icy weather.
What part of it was open?
I have no idea.
The helmet?
Fuck knows. Whatever it was enough to cause hypothermia. Imagine going to work and getting hypothermia.
It looks really hot, an astronaut suit.
Yeah, but in icy cold water.
It looks like a hug from John Candy.
I'd like a hug from John Candy. That'd be quite nice.
Sweet. I bet he smells of tobacco and mint.
Yeah, well, it probably doesn't smell of anything now. I get pissed off if I'm at work and I stub my toe, or if I get a paper cut, or if I put my back out because I haven't lifted something properly. Imagine going to work and contracting hypothermia.
Maybe she didn't move around enough. She didn't accumulate sweat heat.
But I feel actors are renowned for being a little bit, sensitive is the wrong word, but they can be a little bit, not princess-like. What's the word I'm looking for?
A delicate flower.
Yes, that's a good way. That's exactly what I'm looking for.
Edward Norton.
You would have thought that the moment she felt her suit getting liquid in, she would turn around and go, excuse me, my suit's open, I'm freezing.
Oh, is this water? Is this from when she filmed the water scene, she fell in the water?
Well, yeah.
That makes sense.
Based on the fact, yeah, just filming scenes in the icy water.
Mm.
So you would have thought, you would know if you were in a suit feeling dry and then suddenly you feel wet, surely you would turn around and go, oh, Chris, excuse me, hello, yeah, my suit's open.
I didn't realise that bit was filmed in Iceland because I went snorkeling in Silfra in Iceland and my partner's suit didn't. It was too big for her neck and all the ice water went down her back and she had to have 5-6 guys with hot chocolate and blankets. She loved it.
Yeah, well, who wouldn't?
Warmed her up and I stood there looking fat and I was just like, oh, man, these good-looking dudes. Looking after my wife and I'm just doing nothing.
Yeah, but she gets to go home with you. So she's the real winner here.
Oh, man.
Did she get hypothermia?
No.
Well, that's good.
She got hypochondriac.
Oh, okay. Moving swiftly on. Writer, producer and director Christopher Nolan cast Matthew McConaughey after seeing his performance in Mud. He is quoted as saying, I'm thrilled for him right now. I didn't know how much potential he had until I saw Mud, not just as the leading man, but in sheer acting talent. He remarked that in McConaughey, he needed an everyday man who can experience these extraordinary events. Now, I don't know about you, but I think this film was part of the McConaissance.
Yes.
The rising of Matthew McConaughey. Mm. And after watching this film and being a fan of Mr. McConaughey, I think he's great. And seeing him in films like this, in films like Dallas Buyers Club, it makes me really happy for him because he seems like such a dude that when he gets these leading roles that he really excels in. Yeah, I just love it. It's like another candy hug.
DBC is in my top 25 films of all time.
Really?
Yeah.
Because of him or just the film in general?
Just an incredible performance, similar to this as well. I mean, I'll come to it in my likes, but he was maturing for years and waiting for that moment to be uncaught. And then he's doing brilliant films.
Yeah.
I know, obviously, we've spoke about films that came after, like The Dark Tower and Free State of Jones. I was so excited for Free State of Jones, being a huge fan of Civil War, and then it not hitting all the buttons. I was annoyed because it was McConaughey and it was Civil War. I was like, this is amazing. And then it just didn't do it for me.
It must be lovely for McConaughey himself to see directors of Christopher Nolan's caliber, like, bigging him up, giving him props, because he's had a decent career, but for ages he was doing those rom-com roles or those smaller parts. To have a director at the top of his game saying things like that must have been wonderful for him. And I worry that since Dallas Buyers Club, it's almost like he's peaked and now the roles he's getting aren't matching them. Since he's done this, the best film I've seen him in is probably The Gentleman, where
that's a solid film.
Yeah, but he plays quite to type there, doesn't he? He's basically a characterization of himself within that film.
Yeah.
I just hope that he's not on a decline now when he's getting those lesser films, because we know he can do it in films like this, in films like Dallas Buyers Club. I think he's given the right script.
True Detective.
Yeah, oh, exactly. Yeah, given the right content, I think he's amazing.
Mm. Well, when he started out, he had two big dramas he did. A Time to Kill, I think, with Samuel Jackson, and he did Amistad, which I think is a Spielberg film about the slave trade route across Atlantic, and he's a lawyer in it. He's fighting for the rights of a guy who mutineered or broke free from his shackles. So he started out, but I don't think that he got much traction in the early days when he was extremely new. I think he needed to age a little, and he's aged well.
Oh, God, yeah.
He's a good-looking dude. Like in The Gentleman, when he's got that dark burgundy suit on and orders a pickled egg or a scotch egg and a pint of ale, I'm like, dude.
Yeah.
Dude, no one like you looks like that in a pub.
Yeah.
I've seen them dudes.
Yeah.
I've seen them.
I wish we did look like him.
The bulldog breed.
The final fact, the books displayed on the bookshelves shown in this movie were the actual books Nolan had read and used for his research about black holes and singularity.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
All of them books, though.
I don't think he read them all.
Surely not. After hearing this fact, I had a little look at how many books were there, and there is not enough time in a life to read that many.
What was it? Eight columns and about 60 books across? No chance.
It's a hell of a lot of books. It's like a Waterstones amount of books.
He is genius, though, I suppose. His brain is so large, I wouldn't be surprised if he can burn through a book like Johnny Five.
Yeah. Unless it's just the books he's read duplicated time and time again.
Yeah.
But I have huge admiration for anyone that does their research, that does their homework when going into a film, and you just know that's part and parcel with Nolan and his filmmaking, right?
That's caring, isn't it?
Yeah. And especially when the subject matter is so hard to wrap your head around, so difficult to comprehend. If you've got the person that's driving, absorbing as much information as they can in a bid to tell the story as correctly as possible. Yeah, I'm here for that.
As best as he can theorise it, that's what's great, yeah.
Yeah.
So obviously it is mind-boggling to 99.9% of the population on Earth about E equals MC squared and relativity and all that. It's just mind-boggling.
Yeah.
The one that always gets me is the event horizon.
Okay.
We can't see into a black hole or something. Nothing escapes a black hole. I'm like, how do you even know this? Why do you even look for this? I'm so confused.
Mm.
Like, that's where they lose me. Event horizons and wormholes. Relativity, I can comprehend. It makes so much sense because gravity is the same as time and space. And so a planet further away, time moves differently. That makes sense because when you take in gravity into account, you know, what it does, it makes you can comprehend. After watching a few documentaries, reading a little, that one's all right.
Yeah.
I can deal with that. I can swallow that one.
Oh, good, yeah. Well, I'm not going to lie, doing this podcast, particularly this episode about Interstellar, I am looking at you to explain as much as you can to me, because this sort of film, this sort of subject matter, no matter what the film is, no matter the TV show, if I'm reading about it, I go in fully committed and I sit there and I'm like, right, I'm going to understand this dog. And I'm sitting there, I'm going to understand it. And then I watch it. And it's like when I was back at school looking at maths textbooks, going with the best intentions, and then my eyes start to blur. And then I look at it and I'm like, nope, it's beat me. I don't know what's happening. So if throughout this episode you can explain even 0.0001% to me, I'll be very grateful.
I would advise you to read the short science fiction novel by Joe Haldeman called Forever War. It's brilliant.
Does it explain?
He was a Vietnam soldier, and once he left the war, left Vietnam, he wrote this book called Forever War, and it's all about time dilation and space, and they're traveling to fight an unseen enemy, very much like Viet Cong. It's very subtext, but he explains time dilation so well in it. They live in a sort of community of soldiers where, you know, you sleep with each other all night and you smoke dope and that, and it's live as much as you can. But he looks up at the stars in one part in the book, and the girl he's been with forever is going to a completely different planet to him, and he realizes that when they meet again, she could be 80 years older than him.
Yeah.
We're back on Earth because time moves differently. So speed of light, if you're traveling at speed of light and I'm in England sitting in here watching trash on telly, I'm aging a lot faster than you because of the speed you're moving away from the Earth. If you went from the speed of light from Earth as far away as you can, as quickly as you can, there's certain events that haven't happened on Earth yet from that far out. Like when we see a star, that's a sun that's burnt out.
Okay.
Yeah. Time and space.
I'm going to pretend
it's insane.
Understood that and absorbed it.
I'm just regurgitating stuff that I've heard and read.
Okay.
That's not my PhD coming through.
No?
No.
Okay. What did you like about Interstellar?
First and foremost.
Mm-hmm.
First and foremost, having seen it in cinema... exceptional for a cinema anyway, but I love the opening shots when it's done almost like a documentary where people are being interviewed to give context to how the Earth's gone. And one of the first people you see is talking to the camera, and it just looks like real footage, is Ellen Burstyn, who's actually in the film. But the other people that appear, woman two, woman three, woman four, man one, all of them were real people talking about the Dust Bowl era in the US.
See, I did wonder, because I watched that, obviously clocked that Ellen Burstyn was in it, because she's a great actor.
Yeah.
And I was watching that and I was like, no way are these actors, because the way they were delivering it, so in that documentary type format, I was sitting there going, but then I was thinking to myself, how are you doing this? Because the stories that have happened haven't happened.
Do you know where it's from?
But well, yeah.
Ken Burns' documentary Dust Bowl, same guy who did baseball, the one we watched.
Yeah.
It's the same. So he took it from that. That's one of his inspirations for the dust and that, to give it a sense of authenticity. And I loved that, because even though you know Interstellar's not a true story, it was a really, I thought it was a brilliant part of filmmaking to put some real footage from a documentary of the Dust Bowl, which was a terrible time for people to live. I can't remember what sort of region it would have been in. So northwest of Texas and southeast of like Colorado. It was an area where they toiled the land and kept resowing the fields, and what that did is it just kept, and if it didn't rain enough to keep it down and solid and compacted, so the dust kept coming up and it would cause lung problems, and it would just get everywhere. So that's what captured his imagination. It's almost like Frank Herbert, the dune writer, but like the way he was inspired driving on a road that always had sand dunes that invaded it. And that's what got that ball rolling. I feel like Nolan had this. He watched a Ken Burns documentary of the Dust Bowl, and then that started his film off in his head.
Yeah.
It's really, I love that. Look, they had that little documentary part.
Yeah.
And she says, doesn't she, like, well, my dad was a farmer like most people back then. It's great. Gives it such awesome depth.
Yeah. It's a really clever way to ground a film that's so far out there.
Because
if you've got that, like you said, that level of relatability when you're watching it and it feels real because it is talking to people that have experienced something similar.
Yeah.
It does, yeah, when the film's so fantastical, to bring it back down, that's lovely. What else did you like about it?
Hans Zimmer's score is wondrous.
Yeah.
And I read something fascinating about it, that Nolan said to Hans Zimmer, this is all he said to him, was the story is about a man who leaves his daughter or his child, and the sort of hole that would leave in his heart and his life. That's all he told him. Didn't say it was set in space, didn't say anything. And Hans Zimmer started writing.
Really?
So that opening first barrage of music you hear was just purely based on a dad leaves his daughter. How the hell did he know why does it fit so well in space?
That's incredible.
It's amazing, isn't it? And Hans Zimmer is a star. I mean, Gladiator, Dune, Lion King, two of which he won Oscars for, Dune and Lion King, Dunkirk. I think Nolan like him a lot.
Yeah, he's one of the best to ever have done it, right?
But the music, it's one of them films where, especially if it's an IMAX experience or in the cinema, the visuals, obviously being Nolan, are always crisp, brilliant. And then that music, when it kicks in, that sort of space organ, oh, goosebumps. I get goosebumps three or four times throughout that film.
Yeah, the music is insane, intense, powerful. And I wonder if Zimmer is such a huge film fan that he knows Christopher Nolan's body of work. So just by knowing Nolan and through osmosis knows that, well, his films are normally grand in scale. So while I don't know what this one's about, it's probably going to be big. It's probably going to be epic. He's one of the biggest directors working today. So maybe he took that knowledge and that's what he was able to create. That's brilliant.
Yeah, really cool.
What else did you like about the film?
The years of missed messages scene. I think it's worthy of one of the 10 greatest performances of all time.
Yeah, if you can give some context to that scene, because I do agree.
With time dilation again, so Matthew McConaughey is about a third into his mission or halfway into his mission, let's say about a third or halfway into the film as well. And essentially he needs to go down to a planet to obtain data. But on this planet, due to the gravitational pull of Gargantuan, which is a black hole near that planet, time dilation is different. So the gravity on that planet, 1 hour is equals 7 years. On our planet, 1 hour equals 1 hour.
Yeah.
On that planet, 1 hour equals 7 years.
Every hour you spend on that planet, 7 years passes.
And that estimation's off. So Brand's estimation of that time dilation is a little off. Played by Anne Hathaway, as well as the fact that they get held up on that planet due to, that's a terrifying scene. They essentially go to a water planet where every 20 minutes, tsunami's type wave just recycles around the planet. And obviously, they go on the planet, they're on there a bit too long, so they're there an hour. They thought it would be equals about 7 years, but anyway, they get back to their ship. They've been gone 23 years. And the guy they left behind's got grey bits in his hair, and there's this huge backlog of videos that his kids have sent him. And he left when they were 10, 12 years old. And all of a sudden, he knows in reality he's about to press play on these videos, and his kids are going to be 30-something. And he's missed an entire section of life. And McConaughey's performance, watching them videos, is one of the most stunning, striking performances I've ever seen.
Yeah.
The way he cries, the way he hits the points at the right moment. It's excellent as well. Like, Casey Affleck plays the older Timothy Chalamet, who's his son.
Tom.
He has a baby, and that's the first video, one of the first videos McConaughey sees. And then later, he doesn't say that baby died because of the dust issue. He just goes, Grandpa died last week. We buried him next to Jesse.
Yeah.
So he's telling him without wanting to talk about it that his son died as well. So imagine that. Imagine in a space of, say, an hour's passed in your life, and 1 hour, but 23 years has passed. And I honestly think you couldn't have got an actor to have done what McConaughey did there. He managed to put all of that into him and imagine 23 years has just gone and you've lost all of that with your kids, and all of a sudden he just gives the best performance. One of the best.
It is absolutely gut-wrenching, isn't it? When he first sees the messages, he's elated. He starts smiling because his son, this time in the story, is played by Timothy Chalamet. He's telling him about his new girlfriend he's got, and you see McConaughey relax into his chair, like catching up on the latest news from his family. And then you watch his emotions change in, like you say, such a short scene. It goes from pure happiness to be hearing from his boy in an instance where he didn't know if he'd make it back. And then you just see the life drain out of him into despair. And it's that realization, that moment where he clocks that he's missed, well, effectively the whole of his kids' childhood and most of their adulthood. And it's such a succinct scene. It hits differently, doesn't it?
Do you know what? That's how I figured out I had a sore throat, because I started getting a lump in my throat last night watching the film, and I was like, oh, I'm gonna cry. And I did. I had a little blubber, almost like he did.
trying to keep it in.
And I think that might have angered my throat a little.
Oh, so it's Matthew McConaughey's fault.
Man,
any other likes of the film, or shall I go on to mine?
The docking scene. It's one of my favourites. It's one of the best things I've witnessed in a cinema. So I'll give you a little context quickly. Yet again, we're rescuing Matt Damon. We're rescuing him from a planet. He's one of the astronauts that went before them. And essentially, he's not a good guy. He's lied that his planet is survivable and they could do it there because he's a coward. Essentially, they get on the planet. He steals one of their ships and wants to carry on with the mission, and essentially he blows up a part of their main ship, the one that the centrifuge spins to give 1g gravity. The music kicks in. McConaughey's like, we have to join the ship. Matt Damon has just flown out of the airlock, hasn't he? And he goes, we're going to join the ship. And they go, it's not possible. And he says, no, It's necessary.
Yeah.
And the music goes dun 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 dun, and he's just moving towards it and it's spinning. It's just visually, it's insane.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it?
I mean, if you could take a tiny bit from a film, that and the Years of Messages scene.
Oh,
like, and that, there was an Oscar for 60 seconds of film.
Yeah,
you could go, twice. Oh, little 60-second Oscar. 60-second Oscar.
Yeah. And the scale of that really bleeds into what I loved most about the film. And it's just how ambitious it is. It's that scene alone must have been absolutely mental to film.
Nolan in Scandinavian equals ambitious. That's what it means.
Are you being serious?
No.
Oh, you could have gone with that and I would have a hundy believed you.
Yes.
Yeah, so Interstellar is a life-spanning space epic that deals with space, time travel, and a difficult relationship between a father and daughter. And it really is an incredible concept that looks at the future of humanity, the effects of global warming, and the possibility of having to move home to another planet once we've killed this one off. And yes, the runtime is long. It's pushing on 3 hours. But to tell a story as grand as this one...
Mm.
It's quite the feat. Like, I don't necessarily understand all of it or large parts of it, but the sheer scale that it travels through time and space and still manages to make it a very personal story between a father and a daughter is something that I think is, I don't see it being matched in terms of ambition, doing all of that. So the wider picture is this huge, bigger than us, bigger than humanity story. But then at its core, it's about a dad and daughter who are struggling to connect. And to combine the two, I just think it's an outstanding feat of filmmaking.
Well, you know what you said about struggling to understand it? There's nothing wrong with that, because even the brightest minds on Earth have got to the same point Nolan has, essentially. They've got to the same point. It's more theory than proven science.
Yeah.
So relativity was proved, Einstein's theory, but this whole like what's in a black hole and stuff, they don't know. That's why McConaughey has to go into the black hole and to send that data back, doesn't he? So we haven't got to that point in our own real world and our own scientific endeavors. So us not understanding it it's perfect. It fits well because we don't. And our brightest minds can't comprehend that. So yeah. Nolan gave that. Nolan took it one more step further than mankind.
Mm. Yeah,
one small step.
Yeah, I mean that again. That's gonna tie into what else I loved about the film, and it's the man himself, Christopher Nolan. His brand of high concept, intelligent blockbusters has breathed new life into cinema. Now, I think he has faith in his audience's willingness to understand his stories and is continuously looking to break boundaries in the world of filmmaking. And you're totally right. He's not making this film and thinking, oh, I'm going to make geniuses out of my audience. They're going to sit there, absorb this, and their IQ are all going to increase.
Mm.
He knows, and we know as the audience watching it, we're not going to know the little intricacies of the film. We're not going to understand all the science talk, all the jargon and all of that stuff, but you don't have to be able to enjoy something like this.
No.
It's bigger than us. Like the story, it's bigger than humanity. I think this film, and certainly with his latest film, Tenet, they're bigger than the audience. If it's up to the audience and whether they're willing to watch a film and not get every beat of the story and just be able to allow themselves to be absorbed by it.
I comprehend Interstellar a lot more than Tenet. Doesn't mean I didn't enjoy Tenet, but I trying to understand the threat in Tenet, the urgency to solve this huge threat, I couldn't understand it because I'm like, well, a bullet's dangerous regardless of whether it's going backward or forward.
Yeah.
So
it's true, it's true.
The threat didn't grasp me. Whereas in this, the thought of you're now older than your daughter because of time dilation, which is provable possible if you can travel faster than light. That is something you can grasp onto. But at the heart of it, there's the risk of we need to get people off planet because they're all going to die.
Yeah.
So there's two or three things going in this that an audience can grasp. Tenet for me is just like,
yeah.
It's like Shakespeare, I suppose, for someone who doesn't know how to read or write.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think that's the difference. Interstellar can be explained if you're willing to sit there and listen to smarter minds, to people in those fields. They can understand this. And I know through doing some research about the film, he had like the top brains collating with him, collaborating on the film with him.
I wonder who. Brian Cox, Neil deGrasse Tyson, Carl Sagan?
I couldn't tell you off the top of my head, but I know he had someone there that he would speak to and say, well, is this actually correct in terms of science and stuff? Whereas Tenet is just an idea. It's a concept. It's about traveling backwards and all of that sort of stuff. There's not necessarily science behind that. Mm-hmm. But Interstellar, you know, it's rooted, its foundations are in actuality. Like, it could happen. Like,
yeah, but it also shows you in final product with him meeting old Murph. He sees his, in the end, he sees his daughter, and she's, you know, in body, no, in mind, he's 120 years older than he when he left Earth. Mm. His daughter's much older and on her deathbed, and she's yeah. become this genius, saved the world. And that's the shocking thing. Oh my God, it made me cry so much. Honestly, I cried my eyes out last night when he sees her in the bed and she tears up. Oh.
Yeah.
And that's still makes me emotional.
Well, that's another Jesus. Feat in itself, isn't it? That a film so out there in terms of scale, in terms of story, in terms of science, all of that can still make you feel like that. To have a human connection in a story that is so vast and massive. Mm. I think that's really amazing. It's incredible. Also, I loved that Interstellar's just a treat for all of the senses. It's visually stunning and audibly striking. The film is continuously impressive in its style and in its design. And it supports the scale of the piece by being a tour de force of both sight and sound. Mm. I mean, even if you really struggle to grasp the concept that the film's trying to sell, you can just sit there and watch it and listen to it and be entertained and blown away just by how it looks and sounds. Cause it is breathtaking. It is incredible to take it all in. And I love action scenes, but there's also real moments of just pure silence that I feel like properly mirrors what it must be like to be in space. Mm-hmm. There's parts of the film, there's no soundtrack, there's no background music to build atmosphere or anything like that. It's just pure silence.
That's why I love it. And Nolan got that right as well. So yeah. When a part of craft explodes, there's no noise.
Yeah.
And that's amazing because there's no oxygen, there's nowhere for it to travel. So it is silent. Mm. So I like them little details where he stayed true to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What, is there anything you didn't like about the film?
Yeah, there's a couple of things. I could never look part. I loved the voice quality and voice acting of the robots. So Tars and Case.
Yeah.
But I hate their design. They look so impractical. They're a huge square. They're a fridge.
Yeah.
For me, I think that's the only place it fell down in terms of design. They're clunky. They don't fit very well in places you need them to go. I mean, essentially what we're talking about here is a huge computer with an excellent brain, which now you can fit in a phone. So why is it so AI, huge? Isn't it? Well, it's AI, yeah. And they've got obviously got a bit of character, but they're they're these very huge rectangular shaped, like chromium just fridges, and their shape is really off, and it's not what I would call the best most reliable design for what they needed them to do. Like, I just didn't get it.
I see what you mean. In a film that's so groundbreaking, and within the film we're led to believe that it's further along in the future, there's technological advances and all that, the way they look feels quite dated in terms of how science fiction is portrayed.
Well, they were from a war period that we don't see in the film.
So is it a case they're just made to be durable rather than aesthetically pleasing? Or I get what you mean. In such as when it's so compact, the space, every inch counts in the spacecraft. And they got these huge daddy silver fridge refrigerators.
Yeah, I just thought it was an odd choice. Like, yeah. I felt, I mean, you think of like, I say Terminator, like T-1000 or something. Its legs and arms, say it can move really fast. It's strong. It's super strong. It can move fast, and it can fit in. It's less heavy. It can fit in smaller holes. It's more human. I don't know. It was odd because their personalities, their voice acting, and their back and forth with the characters is excellent.
Yeah,
like I really enjoy it. I love that, you know, two of the crew who are humans die in it, but these two robots pretty much live till the very end, and their characters are in themselves. But I just don't like the design. It's too bulky. It doesn't look pretty.
See, I didn't think of it like that, but now you said it, I can totally, I think I'm with you for the large part.
First thing that ever struck me when I saw it at cinema, I was like, that's a weird looking robot.
But then I guess the argument is we've seen AI be represented in almost human form so many humanoids, times in film. Yeah, so cyborgs, humanoids, so they look like us, they move like us. Mm-hmm. And I guess Nolan might have been like, well, I don't want to take the attention away and make people focused on these robots. And the fact that they don't look like anything other than big rectangles, maybe. Because if you're watching this and you had like a cyborg, a robot from any previous scientific films, what's the one with Will Smith that I'm thinking of?
I Am Legend. No, I Am Robot. I, Robot.
Yes, exactly. People looking.
I don't necessarily want humanoid, but it's just the clunk.
Yeah.
The clunky clunk. The
clunk.
I wanted it to be more smaller, aesthetically pleasing.
Compact.
Yeah, smaller, more compact. There's, I mean, it's weird. It doesn't look like it can do some of the things it does in the film. So there's a bit where Anne Hathaway's character is stuck under a piece of old wreckage on the water planet where the time dilates horrendously bad. He goes, Case or Tars, go get Brand. And it turns into like this rolling machine almost. But when you look at it, you think, well, it's so odd. It didn't look like it could do that. And then it does do that. I don't know. Yeah. Aesthetically, I always found it a bit off-putting, but I love the characters within that little fridge.
Yeah.
Smeg fridge.
Yeah. That's an interesting point. Well made. Maybe if they were smaller, compact, and they could expand into this bigger thing when they needed to be multi-purpose, it could have been interesting. But yeah, I see your point. Anything else you didn't like about Interstellar?
So I'm all good for time dilation and relativity. The thing that freaked me out was he messaged himself the coordinates in the bedroom by using books and dust, didn't he? And gravity was a way of communicating. And then he follows them coordinates to NASA's facility where they're about to launch off. And they never had him in mind to be the pilot for the job anyway.
Yeah.
So initially at the start of the film, that annoys me because I'm kind of like, well, see, he wasn't even in the running for the job. But now he's turned up. They're like, do you want to do it? Do you want to go? Do you want to go to space? And then you realize that he would have done it anyway. I don't know. I think that's where it really blows my mind.
Yeah, it's one of many parts of this film that I don't fully comprehend.
He tells himself to go to NASA to get the job to go up there.
Yeah.
To tell himself to go to NASA to get the job to go up there.
Yeah, I guess it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. So it's almost a loop. So
he has to go up there talk to Jessica Chastain's character.
So it all goes into Anne Hathaway's character, you mean? Because Jessica Chastain...
No, Jessica Chastain's his daughter. He has to go up there to communicate to her through the watch.
See, it's inevitable. We're talking about this film's going to cause confusion because the film itself is so confusing.
Yeah, but that's exciting.
Yeah.
It's exciting to prophesize and theorize and stuff. Like, lovely.
Yeah.
Let us know, come down, little Guinness, pipe, and just talk about it.
And if you could just talk at me about this film for an hour or two and I can just try my hardest to walk away and have a little bit more understanding, I would love that.
Yes.
Any more dislikes?
No, I noticed one scene that I felt like I wanted to pick holes in, but it might have a get out. But there is a scene where David Gassi's character Romilly asks if they can stop spinning the centrifuge of the spaceship. And when they do, the whole idea of spinning a centrifuge is to have 1G, which gives the impression that you're on Earth, that you're not floating, yeah?
Okay.
0G is no gravitational, you tend to float.
Right,
or move,
okay.
Yeah. When the centrifuge stops spinning, Matthew McConaughey's strapped in, that's fine. No argument with this. And they're looking at the wormhole because they're about to approach it and about to go into it. And one of the crew is sitting next to him. He's walked over to him during the centrifuge, been 1G, okay? Then it stops spinning and he doesn't float. And he doesn't...
Oh, okay.
He doesn't become weightless. And it's weird because I was kind of like, well, hold on. But then I read some people said, yeah, but you're only seeing the top half of his body. You could have his foot hooked in somewhere and stuff. I was like, yeah. Would it have looked really cool if that ship had stopped spinning and he floated up a little and then held onto the seat? Because then that would have been scientifically correct.
And that would have quenched your thirst. If you'd seen that, you'd be like, oh, that explains that then.
Well, it would have been a great little moment in filming because the minute that ship stopped spinning, you see him float up. That's science, man.
Science, man.
That's science.
Yeah. Well, my dislikes aren't as intelligent or in-depth as yours. And my main one was just the runtime. Oh. It was just almost...
What's your problem, man?
I've got loads of problems, mate. But this specific problem, at almost 3 hours long, it can feel like a slog.
Well, why don't you watch Gravity then with Bullock?
Well, let me finish making my point and then you can tell me off. A film that demands huge brain power can be exhausting, and I, for one, struggle to keep invested for the entirety of the runtime.
Yeah.
I like my long films, I like my ambitious films, and I applaud Interstellar for all of these reasons. I think it's great filmmaking. I think Nolan's a visionary. I think the cast do a great job, well directed, well made. But it does feel like it goes on a bit. And again, I hold my hands up. I'm not sitting here professing that I understand it and it's just boring. I know that the runtime can feel like a drag because a lot of it goes way over my head. And despite the best intentions that I mentioned earlier, the subject matter for me, I don't have as big of a grasp on all of this as you do, but for me, it can sometimes just be a bit too much of a obstacle.
And where did it lose you? Do you recall?
Well, that's going to come up in another dislike. But my second dislike, you'll probably have a go at me for this as well. I found it depressing. Go on.
Oh, no.
No, right. Let me...
It's so full of love, man.
Okay. Watching 3 hours of a film that centres on humanity's inability to look after its home alongside a father missing out on his children's life is tough watch.
They make it.
Yeah, but... And you're right. It is uplifting. There's really inspiring moments. And at the core, it's a father and a daughter combining their powers and their tools to save humanity. So they're all good things. But the fact that it travels through time and space to sadden me is a bit of a hefty punch to absorb. There are uplifting moments for sure, but once it's finally finished, I'm sorry, mate, but I feel exhausted and a little depressed.
That's cool.
Now, I do like this film. I value this film. And I would consider myself a fan of this film. But saying all of that, it does take a lot out of me. And that's probably a me problem. I fully accept that. Hold my hands up. Yep, that's a me problem. Yeah, anyway. And to answer your question, where do I get lost in this? And it's the final 30 minutes. I do not understand it, and I do not like that I do not understand it.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that a lot of people get lost in that final 30 minutes. Yeah. The book thing, yeah, when he goes into the third dimension of a fifth dimensional race that use gravitation to talk to each other, there is very minimal... Teflon going on.
Mate, you may as well be speaking to me in hieroglyphics in that last bit. Yeah. And to pull back the curtain a little bit, I think I've mentioned it before on the podcast. I'd like to watch every film twice, once for note making and another time where I'm just fully focused on the film. I watched this film twice. That's nearly 6 hours of my life. Both times I've watched this and I'm like, right, I'm going to get this. I've watched the film 3 times in total. And each time I get it until that final fucking 30 minutes. And it's like someone's changed the disc in my DVD player and put on a different film.
It could be intentional because it is so hard for our brains to comprehend. I mean, let's say the most intelligent beings on earth are humans. Most intelligent animals on earth are humans. Our brains just can't comprehend it.
Mm.
It's that, and maybe Nolan's intention is to just blow your brain and freak you out. Like, there's no way he could ever explain Tenet. It's a wicked, crazy, odd idea. There's no way he could explain it to people because it's all theory. So you don't have to understand it.
Oh.
Unless it's proven. You burn your hand on a fire. You know you burnt your hand on a fire because it's hot.
Yeah.
But like with this, it's like you can't grasp it.
Don't get it twisted. I'll take a Nolan blockbuster over a Fast and Furious 16 film or a Marvel film every single day of the week.
You could be telling the truth there that it's 16. I don't know.
I don't know. I've lost count. But... I've got to be honest, and there's parts of this film that I do struggle with, and I like to understand what I'm watching. I don't like my hand to be held through watching films, but I like to have a general grasp, and it's those 30 minutes. If I could grasp those final 30 minutes, I think Interstellar would be one of my favourite films because there's so much of the film to love. And despite my best efforts, I think that's what gets me, is I put so much time and effort into trying to understand. And I probably do just have to accept the fact that it's above my pay grade. I'm not there.
But you're just watching a film. If you want to understand it.
Oh, I could research it.
Yeah.
I could.
Yeah, well, or go and read some opinions, some blogs, sort of how people perceive it. And it might open up other avenues.
Yeah. But well, maybe one day.
I'm with you there. It's hard. I can't comprehend that last 30 minutes.
Okay. Well, I feel a little bit better. You're on the same page as me. I've got some questions. Where does Interstellar rank in your list of Nolan films?
Top
of the pops.
Yeah, if I was to go top down, so I'd go Interstellar, Dunkirk, Memento, Tenet, Inception, Dark Knight.
Okay, that's interesting. I would go top of the pile for me, Memento. First time I saw that, I was like, wow, I didn't know films could be this. Second, The Prestige. I think The Prestige is superb, amazing.
I forgot about it.
Yeah. Third, I would probably go The Dark Knight, because I really do love that film. And then maybe Dunkirk, then Interstellar probably.
That's right, Inception, where you put that?
Okay, no, scrap that. I'd put Inception above Interstellar, personally.
Whoa.
Because I can understand it more. It's that simple.
In the cinema or at home?
I saw both Inception and Interstellar at the cinema, and I think that both deserve to be seen on the biggest screen possible.
I think you're wrong.
That's the beauty of Nolan films. The bigger the screen, the better. And I think Nolan's one of those directors that, depending on you who you speak to, everyone's got a rank of five, and they all tend to be different because they're so much to enjoy from what he does. Do you think humanity will ever actually time travel?
No.
Never.
Well, because we'd know. Someone would have come back already.
How do we know they haven't?
Because they haven't.
But how do you know?
Because they haven't.
But how do you know?
It would be impossible because no one's done it. So if we can time travel,
yeah, but in someone would have come back. Yeah, but in the future it could be.
No, because the future is the past.
Okay,
it's the same.
You're using me again.
No, I explain it. Okay. If we can time travel in the future, yeah, then we can come back. Someone would have come back.
Yeah, but it just might not have happened yet.
No, that's the bit you're missing. That's the logic you're missing. It might not have happened yet. If we can do it, we've done it and we've come back. Murphy's Law.
No, that's...
If it can happen, it will happen.
But it could still happen.
No, it couldn't. It would have happened.
What are you saying to me? Why couldn't it not happen later on?
Because the future is now. So we don't know the future, yes? We don't know tomorrow, yeah? We don't know it. So when, say the future, when it does happen, yeah? They'd come back in time and confirm to people they have time travelled. Because it's never happened, it never will.
But maybe this time we're living now is not important enough that someone who has time travelled could have come back. Stop getting in my head, all right? I don't understand what's happening with this.
You're not... Okay, what was it like when you lived in Henry VIII's times? Did you enjoy... Was it nice? What was the air like? What did people look like? Do you have any recollection of it?
Obviously not.
No, your brain wasn't there, was it?
No.
There's no consciousness to it.
Well, I might have been if reincarnation's real.
Yeah. So think about that. Now put your brain in the future. It's not there. It doesn't exist there. So if it hasn't happened, it's not going to happen because it's the future. So go forward 2,000 years and they invent a time machine, yeah? They would have come back and told us. They haven't.
But if it hasn't happened, I think, look, this is a vicious circle and I'm never going to grasp it.
This would help you understand a bit of the logic in Interstellar.
Okay, this feels like a pub talk between me and you, and you'll have to, like, drown me with Guinness and then really explain it to me to the point of drawing diagrams and holding my hand. Interstellar looks at how humanity would respond to the impending death of planet Earth. If you knew the world was going to end, how would you spend your last week here?
Oh, gosh. It's too hard. I couldn't answer, man.
No?
I don't know. Would I be selfish? Would I run away from my family and find a drug dealer and be like, I've not tried any of these drugs, give them to me all at once? You know, would I just... No one would accept currency anymore, because if the world's ending, I'd be like, oh, I'll give you £20,000 if I can steal your boat and find a bunch of models and just disappear into it. It's not going to happen. Like, it's so hard.
Right, this is what I would do.
All right.
I'd go to a dog rescue home. I would break free several dogs that I liked, and I would walk with them as far as I could walk in that week with my dog bros. Just walk out, see how far I could walk in a week.
That's amazing.
And just see how far me and my dog friends could walk, acting on the kindness of strangers, picking up food for them and me wherever I could, and just see from my doorstep how far I could get in the week that's ending.
God, it really is the most depressing thought.
Yeah. I think it's fair to say that I struggled so much with the film that my questions have probably... a direct result of that. They're not my greatest questions.
So if you found out you were dying tomorrow, just you, not the world.
Tomorrow?
Yeah, if you found out you were dying tomorrow, but just you, not the world.
Yeah.
Would you go and break into Battersea Dogs Home and walk with dogs?
No, I'd use what savings I had to go and travel the world until I died.
That's a good one. Because the world isn't ending, you can still enjoy it.
Yeah.
But if the world's ending, me. I don't know what I'd do, man.
It is a depressing question. I'm sorry for bringing you down.
No, maybe having a daughter has a part to play in it.
Well, yeah.
Because I don't mind anymore about myself.
Mm.
But imagine, like, knowing it's the end of her world. Oh, fuck. You're depressing me.
Well, I think it's safe to say from this podcast episode, we found out that you're more intelligent than me and I am more selfish than you, which I think it's a real wake-up call for us both. So try to mood boost a little bit. What would you rate Interstellar out of 10?
9.5.
Well, that's a big old score.
I just got to reflect back to that experience in the cinema.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it the last 30 minutes gave me a headache, but in a good way. I remember stepping out of that cinema, looking up at the sky. It was winter, stars were out. It was marvellous. I just thought, wow, incredible.
What would have made you change it to a perfect 10 out of interest?
TARS.
Yeah?
The design of the robot.
Yeah.
Maybe. I don't know.
I mean,
I think that 0.5 has to be reserved for not understanding it fully. So it's probably to do with that. And, oh, God. No, I know why. Yeah, I know why.
Go on.
Daughter attends school and they say, oh, she came into school and she was talking about the lunar landings, but that's federal text. That's no longer the correct use of knowledge. We never landed on the moon. It was a hoax. It's like, oh, it just, that little bit there just made me so annoyed and angry because it's like, you know, they're like flat earthers and stuff. And the fact that it was even in the film, and I think it's good it was in the film because Nolan's essentially saying, look how idiotic people are with like the moon landing was a hoax. And it's just like, it can't be. Mm. Like there's evidence of it. They've got high res photos of the footprints that were left behind. They use lunar reconnaissance orbiters that reflect lasers back off from where we put them on the planet, on the moon, and they come back to Earth to measure the distance between two. There's so much evidence that they did land on the moon. And the fact that there was 410,000 people involved in getting men on the moon from 20,000 companies, yes, they're all lying. All their families are lying. They all lied.
Yeah, ignorance.
How expensive would that have been?
Yeah.
You know, and it's just, 0.5 because they even uttered the words that we didn't land on the moon.
That's fair enough.
Yeah.
I'll allow that.
Thanks. I had to explain a 0.5.
I was just curious what would have made it get to a perfect score.
Well, why did you give it 7?
I didn't give it 7.
You usually do.
I gave it 7.5.
Jesus, that is so bad.
It's not bad.
It is bad.
All right, if you want to fight me on my rating, you can.
It is bad.
But 7.5 is a bloody good score for a film I don't understand half of it.
It was the best film for its year. The best sci-fi film, probably up until The Martian. Is it better than The Martian? I don't know.
Martian's easier to understand, that's for sure.
Martian's a lot easier to understand.
Yeah.
But it's more unrealistic. I think I've watched some science guys talk about what one was more realistic. I can't remember which one they said was. Who knows?
Okay.
Gravity definitely wasn't.
No. I'm 7.5 to me is a very good score. And it's only that score because of how I struggle with it. And that's after 3 times watching it. Parts that I can't wrap my head around. And again, I can't stress enough, that is definitely a me problem. I understand that.
What about Inception? Like, how do you understand that? Putting a dream within a dream within a dream?
Well, I'd have to watch that again because I haven't seen that for probably about 10 years. So I'd have to watch that again to better understand and recollect my thoughts on that one. But that gives Interstellar a total score of 17 out of 20. If you like your films grand in scale and stunning in spectacle, or if you like your science fiction mixed in with daddy-daughter drama, then Interstellar could be a film for you. Consider watching this one if you enjoyed 2001 A Space Odyssey, Tenet, and Event Horizon. Should we play a game?
Just get on with it.
Oh, sour dad. The game in question is What the Plot, where the rules are simple and the results quite the opposite. Harry will conceive an original idea from his big and beautiful brain and give birth to a plot. It is then down to me to nurture this thought by providing a film title, genre, cast, and anything else I can think of to raise this brainchild into a fully functioning film concept. Over to you, Harry.
Young, 23-year-old single mother. She's a house cleaner. She cleans for a few rich millionaire or politicians' houses in some sort of, I don't know, what's one of the posh areas in the US? Who knows?
Bel Air.
Yeah, well, somewhere in Florida. Wherever, like, Trump resides when he's not in his fat tower. But she essentially cleans for some millionaires. She's young, she's attractive, she's a very hardworking mum. And essentially she gets raped, attacked by one of these huge... He could be a senator or he could be a powerhouse mongrel man. He could own his business. Let's say it's a Trumpy-type character. And essentially, she gets attacked when she's cleaning the house because daddy's home alone. And the story is about her trying to go after this guy who's got, you know, billions. He's got lawyers. He's got people to discredit her, to say, you know, she had an abortion when she was 18. Now she's got this baby. She's done drugs. And deep down, she didn't. She smoked a bit of weed. She had an abortion because she found out the baby was going to be born with deformity or something. So there is explainable things to the things she's done. But then she it's essentially... underdog story, David Goliath. She's going up against this huge business mogul or senator. It depends on whether you want it to be a more political leaning film or a greed film. And essentially it's her story about trying to get people to believe that she was raped by this man, or is she But yeah, you could get one half of the audience who just believe that in within the film that she was doing it all for money and it's a lie. So it could be, yeah, a good story about the truth will out.
So it's not necessarily like a vengeance story.
Not vengeance,
It's like a justice, I'd finding justice story.
Half and half court drama. So maybe the last part of the film is set in court where, you know, maybe she gets this real honest lawyer.
Okay.
And he wants to help her. Right. Maybe like a Richard Jewell almost, but a rape case, you know, young woman, clean, a single mum against a huge business mogul.
Okay.
Hmm. And to a David Bowie soundtrack.
Okay. That's a curveball. Okay. So in summary, we've got a young 23-year-old single mother who is a cleaner to the rich and famous. She's a young and attractive woman that's raped. She goes after the guy who has lots of lawyer support. It's filthy, filthy rich. So as you say, it's a real...
no one's going to believe you.
Yeah, it's a real David versus Goliath story. The film centres on her story trying to find justice, and it's her truth fighting against the lies of someone who has got unlimited resources to disprove
it. Because how many women would not even try to fight that? They just wouldn't try. They would feel like they wouldn't be believed. They'd feel like the court case would be just as worse as the actual act.
Yeah.
So she's, I suppose you could say she's the exception. Let's say it's well before Me Too movement, where honesty was applauded. Let's say it's well before that. You know, could be 90s or something, and just it wouldn't even get past the sergeant on the desk at the police station.
Yeah. Okay. So that is a, I can't see this being anything other than a real gritty drama. Mm. And I think in terms of casting, in that lead role, I'd have Florence Pugh, because I'm a big, big fan. And I think she fits in that sort of...
She's doing great things.
Age demographic. She could play a 23-year-old. Mm-hmm. She's got a wide range of acting talent, so she could play the victim. She can also find that inner strength from somewhere to find the self-belief to fight something of this scale.
Fighting with my family.
It would be such a horrific endeavor to try and tackle such a monster and a beast. And playing that role of that sort of rich, famous business tycoon would be someone who has had a bit of a renaissance of his own recently. Mm-hmm. And in a role that you wouldn't necessarily expect to see him in, but in terms of his size and in terms of his actual untapped acting abilities, I'd have Brendan Fraser.
Whale.
He's going to be in a film by Darren Aronofsky in Whale, where he plays a morbidly obese guy.
That's cool.
And I think the sheer size of him, and I feel like he could play that power hungry sort of person. Mm-hmm. And I think the dynamic between them two, he could be with a couple of really smart and almost treacherous lawyers that are making it even more difficult for Florence Pugh to become successful.
I can imagine hating him in a film like that.
Yeah.
But that's the intention.
Yeah.
I love him as a human.
Yeah, I think most people think Brendan Fraser is an exceptional man that's been dealt with a really shit hand, and I think his personality shined through, and because of who he is, he's finding a second life within film, and I'd like to see him in maybe a villainous role. I think directing the film would be Lynn Ramsey. I think it's important from when the story's from a female perspective, I think it'd be important to have a female voice directing.
What else film. Done?
She's done We Need to Talk About Kevin.
Oh, good.
You Were Never Really Here. Both difficult, uncomfortable, and gritty films.
Kevin, God.
I'd like to turn it on you a little bit. Could you think of any decent casting for the lawyers of this Brendan Fraser really unlikable business tycoon character? Just another lawyer that could be really sneering and horrible and just...
A bad lawyer.
A very good lawyer, but a very bad person.
I was going to go for the good lawyer for Pugh.
You can.
Ryan Gosling.
Yep.
He's charming, he's good looking, he's young, he's got the energy to take on a new big case.
So that's good. If you have a Florence Pugh and a decent, good person lawyer, you'd have Brendan Fraser and a really detestable lawyer in his corner.
I almost said Odenkirk and then realised it's Better Call Saul. I'm just thinking of people that have played lawyers. Ryan Gosling's played a lawyer.
So they play lawyers loads of times. I think Ryan Gosling and Florence Pugh would work amazing together.
Yes,
beautiful. So how Brendan Fraser's lawyer could be a slightly older man.
Oh, I got it.
Go on.
Is Brad Dourif still alive?
I don't know.
From One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. He played Wormtongue in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, we can have him in. If he's still floating about, we can have him there. Yeah. Brad Dourif?
Yeah, that's that's a bad casting.
Yeah.
What fucking world would Brad Dourif?
Okay, well, do you want
Ryan Gosling?
Do you want
Brendan
another?
Brendan Fraser be in a film together?
Do you want another go? We've got time.
No.
So we're going Brad Dourif.
Go Brad Dourif, yeah.
Okay, so we have in the lead role Florence Pugh as her good guy lawyer, Ryan Gosling. The Goliath to her David, would be Brendan Fraser and his detestable lawyer, Brad Dourif. A film directed by Lynn Ramsey, and I'd call it Clean Conscience.
Miss McTiv, is it true you have a history of theft and are a single mother?
Yes, but I only stole because I had a kid to feed.
But you broke the law, didn't you, Miss McTiv?
Yeah, but I was looking for work.
And how many jobs do you have presently?
Three, sir.
And would you still do anything to care for your child?
Of course I would. I'd do anything.
Does that include falsely accusing your very wealthy employer, Mr. Permt?
Wait, what? No, that's not how
Your Honor, Miss McTiv has a lot to gain if she wins this. Mr. Permt, well, he has everything to lose.
McTiv, I know you're struggling, but you gotta fight him. You can win this. You can win this. I believe in you.
This summer, Clean Conscience.